Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. You're listening to a podcast recorded live on the Curiosity stage at the 2019 Festival.
Hi, my name is Liam Pieper, and welcome to the Curiosity stage of Sydney Writers Festival 2019. We meet on the land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and let's please take a moment to acknowledge the traditional custodians of this place, elders past, present and emerging, and all people of First Nations joining us today. Let us remember that the sovereignty of this country was never ceded, and the moral and legal consequences of colonisation remain unresolved. This is the Curiosity stage where writers who are celebrated for one reason talk about a reason they are not necessarily celebrated. They talk about something that fascinates or intrigues them. And today, Brian Washington is talking about Murakami, one of the most fascinating and intriguing writers I know. He only grows more powerful with every book he writes, arguably lazier. He's written the same book five times in a row and nobody has noticed. But no writer can draw you in and submerge you so beautifully in their worlds and their microcosms so that you don't realize 100 pages have passed and he's still talking about spaghetti. No writer that is except Brian Washington, who's one of America's newest literary stars. His collection, Lot, is an astonishing work of microcosm, of community, of sinking into worlds and viewpoints. And, I'm a fan. They got me again. Brian Washington has written for The New Yorker, The New York Times, The New York Times Magazine, The Paris Review, Tin House, BuzzFeed, Bon Appetit, GQ, Vulture, Fader, The Owl, Catapult, and Munchies. A Lot is set in his hometown of Houston and is the confession of a neighborhood channeled through a literary prodigy, according to Matt Johnson, author of Loving Day and Pym. As one of America's newest literary stars, today Brian is going to talk about Haruki Murakami and other modern storytellers to explore how surreal elements enrich the narratives of everyday life and magnify its strangeness. He'll talk about Murakami's structurally loose novels and those that he keeps a steady hand, like Norwegian Wood, with contemporary stories on page and screen. He's particularly interested in those stories with minority protagonists, including Atlanta and Coco, when fantastical elements add feeling and weight. But you're not here to listen to me talk about this, so please, some housekeeping. Please turn off your mobile phones. Feel free to keep them on and quietly tweet the hashtag Sydney Writers Festival. The talk will go for about 20 minutes, at which point Brian will open the floor to questions. Please, if you have a question, please raise your hand and we'll get a roving mic to you. If you have a question, please make sure it's a question and not a declarative statement. And with nothing further ado, please welcome Brian Washington.
So there is a lectern up here and it's marketed as a curiosity lecture, but this is actually gonna be very conversational, very cruisy and laid back. It says 40 minutes, but really we're gonna hit about 23-ish. If I go over 25, then you just throw a fucking shoe at me or something, because no one wants to hear anyone talk for more than 25 minutes. And I think that to start off, what might be most conducive to proving whatever point I'm trying to make is to read a little bit of one of his novels that I really hold dear, and when I say his, I mean Haruki Murakami, called Sputnik Sweetheart, and I'm going to read a little bit of Lot, which is the book that I wrote. And as we talk, I'm going to interchange between both of those texts, because I think that's a way of getting at the lucidity that can exist between two authors that are coming from wildly different composites, irrespective of whether it's geographical, irrespective of whether it's the sort of intellectual paradigms that they're coming from, and then we'll just talk in between that, yeah? The first bit that I'm going to read is from Sputnik Sweetheart, and literally you don't need to know anything going into it. It's the first page. We're just going to jump in, yeah? In the spring of her 22nd year, Sumire fell in love for the first time in her life. An intense love, a veritable tornado sweeping across the plains, flattening everything in its path, tossing things up in the air, ripping them to shreds, crushing them to bits. The tornado's intensity doesn't abate for a second as it blasts across the ocean, laying waste to Angkor Wat, incinerating an Indian jungle. Tigers and all, transforming itself into a Persian desert sandstorm, burying an exotic fortress city under a sea of sand. In short, a love of truly monumental proportions. That's the very beginning of Sputnik Sweetheart, yeah? And now I'm going to read a bit from the collection that I wrote, just to sort of get at the parallelisms that can exist, yeah? Gloria blew through our lives on a Wednesday, and our mother told us to treat her like pottery, to not ask questions, to creep around the house like ants before their queen. Our mother, who returned grape bunches over single sourings, who'd shipped my sister, Nikki, to tech with a knife in her pillowcase, who'd slipped into this country, the United States, this home, her life, on the whim of a fortune teller from the eastern coast of Port Antonio, after she told her, peasant to peasant, that good things came to women who looked to the shore. This premonition cost her $4 American, and if you ask my mother now, you'd think she was still pissed off about it. So Gloria thought my mother was following a manifest destiny, universal to her people, our people, ubiquitous to her heritage, my heritage, although she may not have said this in so many words or even at all, if I'm honest, right? Two books that are wildly different from one another as far as the texts are concerned, and yet I just think it's deeply interesting that someone who's writing so far away can have such a profound impact, whether it's contextually, whether it's structurally, whether it's the forms that are being broken or made. A little bit about how I came across Haruki Murakami. Like, I'm very indebted to libraries, right? When I grew up, I didn't have a lot of money. Like, my parents weren't gonna go to the bookstore and fucking buy me his entire oeuvre. So I would just go to the library right before it closed, and I would look at the covers of these different books, and what immediately attracted me was the cover of Kafka on the Shore. I'm not sure what the cover for the UK and the Commonwealth looked like, but for Australia, it's just like a big fucking face, like a pair of eyes, and it really doesn't tell you anything about the text or what you're going to be reading, and that was like deeply intriguing to me, you know, just these eyes on the bookshelf, and I would look at it for weeks and weeks on end, and I wouldn't touch it, and then eventually one day I had a lovely librarian who said, you know, you can fucking pick the book up, you don't have to pay for it, like, it's fine. So I did, and what really captured me as I read it was that it was unlike anything that I'd ever read before, in that it mixed the sort of surreal with a narrative that was closer to the ground, a domestic narrative, and those two forms wove between one another interchangeably. I just hadn't seen that done before. And it was deeply fascinating to me because that's how most of the stories, I feel like, in our daily lives are experienced, right? You experience the thing, but oftentimes your description of the thing has to be heightened in order to really get at whatever it is that you're talking about, irrespective of whether you're communicating over text, over email, whatever. Sometimes it's small things, like an exclamation point at the end of an email just to show people that you're not a fucking asshole, like, thank you, and so on. And other times it's more serious things, right? A little bit about Haruki Murakami. If you're here, you probably know at least a little bit about him, but he was born in 1949. And when I think of his career, it's usually through four different phases, right? His first two novels, which he himself has called his kitchen table novels. He was originally running a bar simultaneously while writing. And the first one was Hear the Wind Sing, and the second one was Pinball 1973, both of which were published in the States fairly recently. And the next phase in his career was when he starts getting into a little bit of woo-woo territory, right? He writes the domestic novels, and now he's just going to sort of queer things, irrespective of whether that's the immediate environment, whether that's his characters, whether that's his conflicts. And so you get something like A Wild Sheep Chase, right? You get something like the trilogy that ultimately becomes, which culminated in Dance, Dance, Dance. The third phase of his was sort of his money-making phase, right? Where he had established that he could write these different narratives, but there's what you write, and then there's what you write that can sell. And sometimes those two things don't immediately correlate, yeah? Norwegian Wood, which is the novel that he wrote, sold a lot, sold a hell of a lot. He became an international celebrity of sorts, enough to where he had to flee the country. Or as he would say, he had to flee the country in order to sort of cope with it all. And when I think of his fourth phase, for me, it starts with Kafka on the Shore, the first book that I came across, where he has these two divergent forms, and they're weaving in and across one another in a way that's deeply natural. And in this interview that I really fuck with, I'm deeply, deeply interested in it, the Parish of You spoke to him, and they asked about those phases, and he said, this is Murakami speaking, what I was trying to do in my first two books was to deconstruct the traditional Japanese novel. By deconstruct, I mean remove everything inside, leaving only the framework. Then I had to fill the framework in with something fresh and original. I discovered how to do it successfully only after my third book, A Wild Sheep Chase, in 1982. The first two novels were helpful in the learning process, no more than that. I consider A Wild Sheep Chase to be the true beginning of my style. And when people think about Murakami, none of these sort of establish a sort of worldwide fame. It's usually within the context of his recurring motifs, right? The things that he returns to. If we were going to raise our hands and sort of list off the things that we immediately assume or think of when we think of Murakami, spaghetti might be one, right? It seems everyone eats spaghetti in each of his texts, irrespective of whether it's a short form or a long form text. There's sex, right? Everyone fucks in his texts, which is remarkable as an American reader because people don't have sex in contemporary American literary fiction, right? It's just not something that you see. So that in and of itself is radical, just seeing it on the page and having it exist and be its own reality, right? Something that people do. And another thing that you'll see is the presence of ghosts, right? Ghosts of who someone may have been 6 months ago, an implicit ghost, actual ghosts, explicit ghosts going to a place that had previously been inhabited and now it isn't. Or in some cases, at least, I'm from Houston, right? A city that's undergoing a massive, massive gentrification crisis. I'm not sure what the situation is in Sydney, but you don't necessarily have to evacuate an area or clear it out in order to find yourself in a ghost town, right? If there's a building that you'd occupied or that you'd attended frequently for 5 years, that building gets razed and all of a sudden it's a coffee shop, you're essentially living in a ghost town, yeah? The memories of who you were when you were going to that place, the memory of the folks that you were meeting when you were at that place, you know, those are ghosts, as far as I'm concerned. And essentially, you find yourself living through a series of ghost stories, yeah? But a bit about the surreality. What captured me with Murakami was the way that it was understated, right? In the description for this, I would set up and talk a little bit about the show called Atlanta. It's in the States. It was shown on FX. And that show was directed by a guy named Hiro Murai. And he's talked a little bit about how Murakami influenced his structuring of the show, the aesthetic that he was looking to approach, the sort of tonal shifts that he was looking to hit. And Atlanta takes place in Atlanta, which you probably could have fucking surmised, which isn't a city that is immediately associated with the supernatural, I suppose you could say, yeah? Because at least in American narratives, when you have the strange thing happen to a group of people, it's usually three white boys and like their dog, right? Or three white boys and the token white girl, and they fall into a hole and all of a sudden they're in Narnia, right? Or they get on a train and they're shipped to a magical school, right? Where everyone looks like them, yeah? And what's interesting to me about Atlanta, directed by a Japanese-American guy named Hiro Murai, who himself was influenced by a Japanese writer named Haruki Murakami, is the way in which he sort of destabilizes the expectation for the viewer about where magic can exist. And it posits that question on everyone who's watching it. Once they see it, if they think that it's unreal, if they think that it's something that's not natural, it makes you question yourself, like, why didn't I think that was natural, right? What is it about these communities that are mostly filled with marginalized folks or folks who are from ethnic minorities that I thought that, you know, magic wouldn't occur? Like, why am I thinking that? I guess an example, and I'll switch back and forth, of this sort of surreality is in one of his first collections, and by him, I mean Haruki Murakami, a story called A Chance Traveler, where he talks a little bit about how he jumps in between those phases, right? Reality as it's lived and reality as it's experienced, and that sort of heightened reality and sort of treading the line between them. And the story is fiction, but here he is talking in Murakami's voice. And he says, "The I here, you should know, means me, the author, Haruki Murakami. Mostly this is a third-person narrative, but here at the beginning, the narrator doesn't make an appearance. Just like an old-fashioned play where the narrator stands before the curtain, delivers a prologue, then bows out, I appreciate your patience and I promise I won't keep you long. The reason I've turned up here is that I thought it best to relate directly to several so-called strange events that have happened to me. Actually, events of this kind happen quite often. Some of them are significant and have affected my life in one way or another, and others are insignificant incidents that have no impact at all, at least I think so. Whenever I bring up these incidents, say, in a group discussion, I never get much of a reaction. Most people just make some non-committal comments and it never goes anywhere. It never jump-starts the conversation, never spurs someone else to bring up something similar that's happened to him. The topic I bring up is like so much water flowing down the wrong channel and being sucked up in a nameless stretch of sand. No one says anything for a while, then invariably someone changes the subject, because that's what we do when we're approached with something that we're uncomfortable with, right? The unnatural, the supernatural, people change the subject because no one knows how to approach it. At first, I thought I was telling the story wrong, so one time I tried writing it down as an essay, and I figured if I did that, maybe people would take it more seriously. but no one seemed to believe what I'd written. You've made it all up, right? I don't know how many times I've heard that. Since I'm a novelist, people assume that anything I say or write must have a touch of make-believe. Granted, my fiction contains more than its share of invention, but when I'm not writing fiction, I don't go out of my way to make up meaningless stories. As a kind of preface to a tale, then, I'd like to briefly relate some strange experiences I've had. I'll stick to the trifling and significant ones. If I started in on the life-changing experiences, I'd use up most of my allotted space. Right. So this is a story that he wrote, a sort of throwaway story, if you will. It isn't one of his 800-page long tomes, but he begins it by broaching the question of what is real, right? And how do our realities differ from one another? And how can that impact the stories that we're telling, the stories that we're seeing based on the vantage points with which we find ourselves in? And he talks a little bit more about that idea in the same interview, the same Parish Review interview, where he says, I don't know why I keep writing those things. I find that in John Irving's work, every book of his, there's some person with a body part that's missing. I don't know why he keeps writing about those missing parts. Probably he doesn't know himself. For me, it's the same thing. My protagonist is always missing something. He's searching for that missing thing. It's like the Holy Grail or Philip Marlowe. When my protagonist misses something, he has to search for it. He's like Odysseus. He experiences so many strange things in the course of his search, and he has to survive those experiences. And in the end, he finds what he was searching for. But he's not sure it's the same thing. I think that's the motif of my books. Where do those things come from? I don't know. It fits me. It's the driving power of my stories, missing and searching and finding, and disappointment, a new kind of awareness of the world. So when I was looking to write Lot, which is first book, story collection, interconnected stories that are set in Houston, Haruki Murakami was an influence of mine, but it's been fascinating for me when I've been doing publicity tours, when I've been talking to people about the books, the way in which they disassociate the text that I wrote from the text that, you know, this Japanese guy wrote. Obviously there's the visual difference, right, which can be confusing for some people, but more significantly than that, it's the question of content, right? Like, how can these experiences correlate with yours, right? And I think that one of those connectors is the sort of emphasis on that surreality, yeah? And what happens when you queer a space? What happens when you inject an unlike thing into a situation that you think you know? So that was something that I was thinking of when I wrote one of the stories in the collection. It's called Bayou. I'm going to read a little bit of it. You don't need to know much going into it, except that there's a chupacabra, which I've been told is not a huge thing in Australia. But a brief primer, if you've seen a raccoon, then you've seen what most people think is a chupacabra, a sort of mythical animal that was originated in Puerto Rico, or the myth was originated in Puerto Rico. And in Texas, where I'm from, it's just a thing. In northern Mexico, it's just a thing, yeah? Mix found his chupacabra next to the bayou, under the bridge, and by the time he ran to fetch me, it had bled in the water and died. For better or worse, this wasn't the worst thing that had happened. Mix and I were broke. We'd flunked out of the community college. My girlfriend, Denise, was having someone else's baby, and I'd been living down by Shepherd, out in the Heights, back with my grandmother. Her place sat behind what were basically cardboard houses, leaning against the wind like a baby dribbled them in, and Granite started slipping Navy pamphlets under my door, which makes it called unfortunate and debilitating, but hilarious. Like, picture my fat ass in a uniform. You couldn't even do it without the buttons popping off and hitting you in the nose. But that these things could keep happening and life could keep going was more mysterious to me than whatever the fuck he was showing me now. Also, it was hot, typical Houston. The chupacabra was hairless and brown and pale under the paws, and I looked at the body with the gnats creeping around it. And then it mixed, and then the chupacabra again, and I thought about whether the stench was rigor mortis or just the sunburnt factories lining the tin. Mick said it might be a dog or something, but obviously it was not a fucking dog. I knew fucking dogs. We have them all over the block. The north side was where they came to die, between the alleys and the laundromats lining the feeder. No, this thing had fat fangs, it had crooked ears, it had stripes on its back, and it looked a little spooked, like it had made some big mistake, like it had been looking for something better, but it had ended up with us. But an hour later, it coughed, and Mix said, fuck! Mix was barefoot, so he poked it with a hairy toe, and the chupacabra's torso sort of deflated, and its chest began to rise and sink and rise and sink and rise and sink again. And Mix reached for my phone, and I told him I had to jet, I had to go. And he said, you have to work. He said, I give you the gift of modern mystery, and you dodge it to go sweep for some fucking gabachos, which is not a nice word in Spanish. I said, gabachos did better than everyone else. It makes sense. You've got no class, no vision. And I said, I don't have a fucking checking account, a savings account. I have no money. I have no choice. I have to go to work. And Mick said, here to put them, motherfuckers always have a choice. So he popped a squat with my cell phone, and he snapped like 12 photos for Instagram, and the flash had both of us wincing. To Darius, he said, this is our big break right here. With this fucking thing, we make ourselves viral. So Mick stepped around the chupacabra, holding the phone and snapping photo after photo. He lifted its legs, he flipped the body on its side, and the chupacabra wheezed a little, jerking its ears, and Mick threw back his hand, but it only began to snore. So we unclenched, we exhaled. And I said, if it wakes up with a paycheck, then I'll stay. And Mick said, you don't get it. Let's say we break fucking even with this. And I say, you go ahead and hold your breath. And Mick said, I'm keeping your phone. And I said, why? And Mick said, I'm gonna call the fucking Houston Chronicle. I'm gonna call fucking Barack Obama, fucking KUHF, Monsters and A-Leaf. You can't make this shit up. And I said, but you probably could. And then I said, it's probably just a raccoon. And Mick said, go off and play kitchen. And he was already dialing on his phone. He said, go off and play the other man, earn some pennies for your bastard. And I said, hey man, you fuck all the way off with that. And Mick said, it's not like you don't already know. And I started to say that knowing something doesn't give you free license to shout it. Like how I knew Mick was queer, but it wasn't something that we ever talked about. But then the chupacabra opened its eyes and the two of us jumped, and then Mick fell on his ass and I was right behind him. And it looked up at the both of us. So we froze, we held our breath. And it talons like gloss talc, and they tore at the grass, and the chupacabra shivered, sort of, as if though the heat weren't shit to it at all. And the chupacabra could have been hungry or thirsty or lost, or maybe all of those things, or maybe none of them at all. And I looked at Mick to tell him, like, we should totally leave it alone. We've all seen this movie before. We know what happens to people who look like us when this happens. And Mick caught my eye, and he lifted a single finger, and he was on the phone popping off about what a fucking discovery we just made. Right? So, narrative that takes place in Houston, Texas, obviously a very long way from Japan, probably 17 hours if you're flying Air Narita. And yet, that idea of the surreality that can take place in a neighborhood that you don't think it will take place in, that sort of connects those two stories, and that's something that's always been deeply interesting to me. I feel like, I'll talk about two more things, and then we'll sort of move on and see how much time we have. Another thing that Haruki Murakami has sort of been lauded with is sort of the approachability of his works, right? And that's something that immediately captured me as I was reading his initial works. The way in which he could talk about 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 things, and yet the language was a lexicon that was accessible, right? You didn't need to approach it from a critical paradigm in order to have a general idea of what was happening, right? And largely that's the work of his translators, right? Philip Gabriel, Jay Rubin, Ted Goosen, folks who are bringing the work to American audiences, or English-speaking audiences, rather, in a way that they can take part in it. And when Murakami was asked about that, he said, I don't want to write about foreigners in foreign countries. I want to write about Japan, about our life here. I want to write about us. That's important to me. Many people say that my style is accessible to Westerners, and that might be true, but my stories are my own, and they are not Westernized. When I write about people eating McDonald's hamburger, Americans wonder, why is this character eating a hamburger instead of tofu? It's a very American question. But eating a hamburger is very natural to us. It's an everyday thing. So the way people act, the way people talk, the way people react, the way people think is very Japanese. No Japanese readers, almost no Japanese readers, complain that my stories are different from our life. I'm trying to write about the Japanese. I want to write about what we are, where we are going, why we are here. That's my thing, I guess. And that's deeply interesting to me as someone who has written a book that when I've talked to folks, they immediately focus on the fact that it's taking place in marginalized communities, right? Taking place amongst ethnic minorities, taking place amongst queer folks, taking place amongst religious minorities. And the question becomes, why are you doing that, right? And why are you doing it in such a way that it doesn't harp on their marginalization, which is a way of writing about marginalized folks, right? You have the one black character, you have the one woman in the story, and she's used as a sort of crux for, you know, the cis white dude to figure something else out about his life, yeah? She appears once and then she disappears forever. Why aren't you doing that? And that's because the marginalized typically don't think of themselves solely through the lens of their marginalization, right? They still have hopes, still have dreams, still have ambitions, still gotta go to fucking work, still wanna have sex, still can't do that sometimes, and they have to deal with those things, right? Irrespective of whatever structural violence is being put upon them, irrespective of whether whatever inter-community violence is put upon them, whatever intra-community violence is put upon them, that locality is something that's always deeply interesting to me, and it's present throughout each of Murakami's novels, irrespective of whether it's very close to the ground, like Sputnik's Sweetheart, or South of the Border, West of the Sun, or whether it's 1Q84, very Japanese novels, After Dark, a very Japanese novel, and yet it's approachable by American readers, by Australian readers, by Mexican readers. You're able to see yourself in it, and it goes back to that adage of within specificity, there's a sort of universality. I deeply, deeply think that Murakami captures that, and he captured it in such a way that it was wildly inspiring for me. And I suppose one thing that I'll finish on is something that I mentioned a bit earlier, the fucking that Murakami writes about. The fact that he writes about sex, the fact that he writes about food, the fact that he writes about pleasure in a way that that pleasure is reciprocal for each of the parties that are taking place in it. Because there is a way of writing about sex, there's a way of writing about pleasure and who gets it where only one party is taking part in it, or only one party is an active participant in it. And when I think of that, I immediately think of two novels. One of them was called, I'm not gonna talk about that one. The second one was called A Personal Matter by Kenzaburo Oe, another Japanese author, seminal Japanese text. A man is living his life, he goes through the motions, he meets a woman, and her sole purpose in the novel is so that he can have a sort of epiphany and figure out whatever the fuck he needs to figure out, and then she disappears, right? She's just a tool within the text. And those were the only kinds of narratives with sex that I had read for the longest time, right? Narratives in which people are tools in order for the protagonist to figure something else out about them, and yet they're disposed of immediately afterwards. And when you read that over and over and over and over again, it can sway your conception of what can be done on the page, yeah? But when Murakami has talked about the sex in his works, or when he's asked about it, he said that, I think sex is an act of a kind of soul commitment. If the sex is good, your injury will be healed, your imagination will be invigorated. It's a kind of passage to the upper area, to the better place. In that sense, in my stories, women are mediums, harbingers of the coming world. That's why they always come to my protagonist. He doesn't go to them. In my books and stories, women are mediums in a sense. The function of the medium is to make something happen through herself. It's a kind of system to be experienced. The protagonist is always led somewhere by the medium, and the visions that he sees are shown to him by her, right? And that him by her is deeply, deeply important to me, right? The fact that the protagonist, who's usually a cis male, is being shown something by her that gives her the agency, that gives her the authority, right? Because in that sense, the power balance is tipped over to her, right? Because sex, when you're writing about it, is ultimately about power, right? It's ultimately a conversation about who has stakes and how those stakes are being used. So to see it in a way where sometimes it was reciprocal, sometimes it wasn't, but it was simultaneously moving the story forward in such a way that both sides are deriving pleasure, both sides are receiving some sort of enlightenment, they're getting to a certain place. That was deeply inspiring to me, right? It was something I just hadn't seen before. And to see someone do it over and over and over and over again, and to see that it's a motif in his text, a way of life for him, was deeply, deeply ingrained, I suppose, in my own writing. So one thing that I'm gonna close out with, I'm gonna read a little bitty passage, and it's gonna take about fucking 4 or 5 minutes from Lot. It'll be the last story. You really don't need to know much going into it, but I do think that it's the culmination of many of the things that so deeply inspire me about Murakami, right? The questions that he posits about whether one should stay in a place, whether one should leave in a place, whether the place that they're staying or leaving is a physical space, or whether it's a state of mind, a way of being, the sex, the presence of food, the way in which food can act as a source of pleasure, the way in which it may not, the way in which the act of cooking for someone is an act of love, it is a gift that you are giving someone, the approachability, the accessibility of language, all of those things, you read X amount of texts and you take what you can from them and you do the best that you can. So I'm gonna read the last bit of this story and then we're gonna close out. So I hear knocking at my door and of course it's Miguel. Dude's in the same clothes that I saw him in last, and he asks if he can come into my home, and I say, fuck no. But inevitably, we post up in the kitchen, and he sits, and I sit, and he says, are you gonna offer me something to drink? And I say, don't give me that faggot shit. So he shrugs. He says, does that mean you're dry? And I say, it means that I've got nada. It means I've got nothing for you. Then, says Miguel, I guess I'm fine. And after a while, he rubs his palms over the table. But there are eggs in the fridge, and they're beside leftover beans from the Castillo, the restaurant where we both work, and those sit in some Tupperware above a flimsy bag of tortillas. So I crack the yolks into something like a scramble, and I fry the pinto beans beside them, and I fold the whole thing onto some tortillas above some slices of aguacate with shredded cheese, and I tell Miguel that he's shit out of luck for salsa because I don't fucking do that. But Miguel doesn't say anything. He's just got this fucking look on his face. He says, you didn't have to. And I say, you wouldn't have shut the fuck up if I hadn't. So I watch Miguel eat, and he watches me watch him eat, and he says, it's good. And I say, yeah, it's fucking free. And I ask if he's heard from his parents. He doesn't look my way, just keeps chewing his food, but eventually he says that they're fine, that they've flown back to their country. He says they made it back to their town, but they don't have a phone. They call from the market in the square, and all I hear are the fucking roosters. And I say, that sounds like a terrible time. And Miguel says it's what they know. And I say, maybe one day they'll wake up. And Miguel says, maybe. And he runs his hands across the table again. And I say, do you think that they'll miss it here in the States? And he finally looks up at me. Miguel looks me in the eyes. And he says, you go somewhere else, and then you stay there, and then you go back home, and then you can tell me how they're feeling. And I say, I just might. And he says, you should have gone with your mother. You should have left Houston. You're being a little bitch, a pato. And I say, just like you should have flown back to the jungle with your parents, but you're still here. And I knock on the wood between us. And Miguel says, I'm still here, and he knocks on it too. And he still could go. Miguel could leave tomorrow. He could pack a suitcase and catch a flight, and I know that I could too. I could pack my shit and just leave, and it'd cost nothing at all. But the same way that I know this, I know that I probably won't. I know that even if we don't always do the things that need to be done, we do the things that we need to do. I know this the same way that I know Miguel is beside me in this room, standing where my mother, my father, my brother, my sister have in the years and the days before. And he keeps an arm's length away. He looks at the photos on the wall, and I realize that I'm the last one in this house. Miguel sees a particular picture, and he asks if the boy in the sweater is my brother. And he says, I could hardly tell, and he's squinting at the photo, and he says, you don't look anything like him. And inevitably, of course, we end up upstairs. Neither of us says shit about it. In my bedroom, the one I used to share with my brother. And I don't know how he ends up on top of me, but he does. I'm thinking that he'll laugh, or he'll smirk, or he'll make some kind of joke. But he's got this serious look on his face. And then there's the pressure again, and he's shifting his weight, ripping at her sweats. And he says, está bien. And I say, no. And he says, really? And I say, no. And he says, this is not how it usually goes for you. And then he slips himself inside of me, and I call him something I don't mean to. And Miguel says, bueno. And it takes a while, and he finishes on my chest. And he asks why I'm crying, and I tell him that I'm not. I tell him to stop bullshitting. And Miguel opens his mouth to say something, but he doesn't. He just breathes down on my neck, and then I'm hard again. And then he's back inside of me, but this time it's sweeter, like something that makes sense. And I'm telling him to stay, and he's telling me the same, and then the words start blending together, and we're saying it in chorus, to stay, to stay, to stay, to stay. So that idea of staying and leaving, that idea of pleasure, this reality that can exist in a very mundane practice, the locality of a text, whether it's language that are spoken, whether it's shorthand, whether it's colloquialities, whether it's accessibility, all of those things are things that Murakami does. All of those are things that I value most in texts. And I suppose I say this not as someone who's written a book or as a critical person or as a scholar, but solely as a fan. I think that the work that those ideas can do transcend borders, obviously, but they can transcend ethnicities, they can transcend religions, they can transcend languages. And I think that more so than anything else, I'm just deeply grateful for what he's given us, because it really is a gift to see yourself in someone else's eyes when that person is so different from you. Yeah? That's it.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to subscribe and rate our channel.